Philip Needleman is a retired former chief scientist of Pharmacia. He's been an incisive contributor to the fields of organic nitrates, angiotensin, the three families of arachidonic acid metabolites, and atropeptins.
I wanted to start the beginning of your career. You got a BS and an MS at Philadelphia College of Pharmacy. What had inspired you to take that path?
Pretty much tongue-in-cheek story. My high school counselor told me not to go to college. I was too wild and I'd waste my parents' money. Well, I'm first generation, so my father was an immigrant and my mother was an immigrant. He got a pharmacy degree, a one-year pharmacy degree. So what did we know? My older brother was in pharmacy school. Later, my younger brother, my wife's father, her mother's brothers. You know, when these immigrants came, there was a stage before they got into medical school and to law school, and it was a predictable living. I got into that pharmacy school because they automatically took siblings if your parents sent $100. I don't know whatever I've done. And then, of course, I met Simma, my wife, when she was 16 and I was 17. And she was especially bright. She was like number one in an accelerated junior high school. And so I decided I wanted to impress that girl. So I went to pharmacy school and gave up some of my habits and started to study. And then you pretty quickly look around and say, well, I don't really want to be a pharmacist. And I had a great teacher in pharmacology. That really made me go for a master's degree and then to continue. Then I went for a PhD in the University of Maryland Medical School. So I was captivated early in my life about pharmacology, which really requires the dissection of the basis of a disease so you can get control, chemical control. So,
what was going on in the biochemical world at this point? Was there much activity there yet?
Well, that's pretty interesting because it influenced my decisions about what I did later. Pharmacology in the 60s was pretty much looking at the responses of whole systems. So you would measure blood pressures and contractions and the interaction of whole systems in the body or behaviors with kind of mazes and so on. In the 60s, it became clear that instead of studying phenomena, it was pretty much important that you start to understand biochemistry so you can understand the chemical changes in the body that were really influencing disease. I caught on about after I finished with my master's degree, and then when I had to select my thesis project, I wanted to take a biochemical one. And then I knew for my postdoctoral training, I really ought to understand biochemistry. So I went off to really strengthen that part of the thinking.
Where did you do that?
I did my postdoc at Washington University in St. Louis. That was 1964. I would say that my family understood nothing about going to graduate school. They thought, now I'm going to really make some money and make a living. And I hadn't been west of, I would say, Paterson, New Jersey. I probably wasn't 5 miles off the Hudson River. And we thought we would go to St. Louis for 2 years and 1 second and be a postdoc in 1964, and we'll never leave St. Louis. So then that was such a spectacular place and such a spectacular education that the crux of my training came at Washington U. It's a very special place, and then St. Louis was a very special place.
What kind of things were you studying when you were doing your doctorate and even before?
The only biochemically related problem that was underway in the University of Maryland Medical School when I said I wanted to do that for a thesis, I was offered a problem that the department members worked on and didn't succeed, and it was to study the breakdown of nitroglycerin. Nitroglycerin popped under the tongue for the rapid treatment of this cardiac anginal pain. And there was a paper in the literature, no one could get it to work, and I worked on it, worked on it. I couldn't even get the assay to work. And I remember figuring out that, I think it was Washington's birthday, the library was closed, when I figured there's something wrong with one of the reagents. I figured the concentration was wrong, and I just made a supersaturated solution. I just poured the chemical in, stirred it. What you're trying to do is a chemical reaction that reads out the breakdown of nitroglycerin that gives a faint pink color. And it was getting no color at all. I did the saturation, added a little bit, turned so red it was black. Someone in their notes when I went back put the decimal place all wrong. So once I figured that out, it took me 14 months to finish my PhD. I completely characterized the enzyme that broke down nitroglycerin in the liver. You know, you would think that's a mundane problem. Then I figured, well, the drug does something to the body, then the body does something to the drug. So I figured out what happened to the nitroglycerin. And I taught myself, then it was new methods and thin layer chromatography. And I identified some new spots at about the time I ran out of the pure nitroglycerin. And so I actually looked up the old German Beilstein and translated the German and synthesized my own nitroglycerin behind an explosion shield. It wasn't too risky. As luck would have it, the intermediates in the synthesis were the same as the breakdown product. I then saw that was the major thing that the body made. And then I even studied the liver. I learned how to perfuse the liver. I then synthesized radioactive nitroglycerin, showed this is the way it works. Now, when it became important was when I figured out how fast the metabolism was happening. And I couldn't believe it. So I kept redoing it. And they used to use radioactive dyes to do liver function in patients. And that's cleared by the liver in one pass. The drug is destroyed in one pass across the liver. Without knowing it, I discovered something called first pass kinetics. When you take a drug orally, for example, through the stomach, in the intestines, the entire blood of the intestine drains into the liver.
With any drug?
With any drug. So oral absorption, it goes to the liver and then it goes out. If you take it under the tongue, goes back superior vena cava to the heart, out to the whole circulation, only about 10% of the cardiac output goes to the liver. So then I went back and showed that the breakdown products were biologically inactive. So I said, this drug can't work orally. So then I learned a way to measure a blood pressure response. And either if I injected it in the vein, which is like sublingual, I can get concentration-dependent fall in blood pressure. If I inject it into the liver, there was never a fall in blood pressure. So now on the market was a lot of compounds. Since nitroglycerin is for the acute, there were a lot of compounds taken orally for prophylaxis to prevent it. So I tested all of them, and some of them were broken down even faster than nitroglycerin. So as a young graduate student, I gave one of my first seminars, and I wrote a seminar abstract, and I thought about five people would come, and the room was jammed. It was called, Is There Such a Thing as a Long-Acting Nitrate? And the guy introduced me, and I said, well, I can make it short and say the answer is no, and sit down. And then I laid out the case that none of these things could possibly have worked. So as a young scientist then, and as a postdoc, I got an American Heart grant, and American Heart released this kind of publicly. And then as a young postdoc then even, I was attacked in these lead journals. What is this kind of young PhD working with rats undermining this major class of drugs? See, this all serves me then later in my life. Ultimately, one pharmaceutical company made a radioactive derivative of a big one called Peritrate and showed that it was right. And then if you search the clinical literature, you have to understand that much of the early FDA work was on safety, not efficacy. Only later was it efficacy. And then someone had done a paper and they looked at all the studies and all the studies that showed profound efficacy of these orally active nitrates lacked placebo-blinded, double-blind control experiments. And whenever there was a double-blind, it was 50-50. In other words, orally they didn't work and sublingually they did. And so in my PhD training, the bad news and the good news was everyone left me alone, so that made me independent and really not risk adverse. I certainly was enthusiastic and energetic and dedicated, and I could sniff a problem, but the formal education came later at Washington U.
So previous to your work, they knew that this had worked sublingually, but they didn't know why.
Under the tongue, it works. They thought it worked orally. You know, that should ring a bell for you about Premarin and a lot of other things. There's a lot of anecdotal data without rigorous double-blind placebo control, the gold standard. You could really be had, and it could be profound placebo responses. Angina pectoris, that pain in the chest, and could be greatly influenced by a physician laying the hand on the patient, stay calm, the acute attack. So it brings you back to even the state of a lot of medications and a lot of anecdotes, and it raises real worries about nutritional supplements, OTC drugs, which don't have rigorous trials, or they make claims on trials and the data is garbage and it's not been in a refereed high-quality journal.
And they're not dosage-regulated either, are they?
That's right. And you don't know a natural product if you get an excess or not. So I was advised by someone. I applied to both the NIH to be a postdoctoral fellow. There was the great person there by the name of B.B. Brody, who was kind of the father of drug metabolism. Or someone advised me about this great biochemist who was the head of pharmacology at Washington University in St. Louis by the name of Lowry. And because of that person, I went there, and I was a postdoc for 3 years, and then happily, I think only because they thought I was going to be a good teacher, yeah, it was probably still too wild to guess if I was going to be a good scientist, I was offered a staff position.
So once you got there, were you continuing work in the same...
That was pretty fascinating. My primary mentor was this great scientist, Oliver Lowry, and he had invented these wonderful, exquisite methods with the tiniest amounts of tissue that you can measure all of the stages of carbohydrate metabolism and dissect pieces of brain. It was so hypnotic that for a number of years after my postdoc, I was so influenced by that. It took me a few years to recognize that the work was just kind of a roadmap to nowhere. And so I kind of pretty impulsively threw it all out and said, what I've learned is you don't do science by taking methods and try and use it to solve problems. You pick the problem and then find out the methods. And so I was in a limbo. So I went back to my thesis problem. But this time I became interested in the fact that people who work in dynamite plants, nitroglycerin, at first have profound headaches. And after a while, they're gone. But every so often, when they go to vacation and come back, they drop dead. And it became clear that patients were developing a lack of responsiveness of tolerance. So I decided to study the mechanisms of tolerance. And that was very productive. And ultimately, I found what it caused out right in the blood vessels itself was a mechanistic change by changing the chemistry of blood vessels. So it was pretty novel during those times.
I was going to ask you something about tolerance. Does that work across the board for
all? So it crosses over to the other nitrates, but not other things that lower blood pressure or not. So it's molecule specific for the nitrate part. And that was kind of decisive. Washington University is, I still think, and I've been around the block now, certainly was then, probably still now, was a rare place. It was such a collegial environment. You know, I think tongue-in-cheek, it might be the kind of person who's willing to live in the Midwest. There weren't prima donnas. It wasn't a medical school, medicine department domination of preclinical, sharing of fellows and resources. It really was a place where the person is the only rate-limiting step. So it was a very wonderful place. Plus, there were stars. I mean, still Corey, the father of carbohydrate metabolism there. So it was a great watering hole. And so, like, I was just like a sponge for years, these seminars, these people. It was just wonderful. So I was working on a nitrate problem, and I needed a reagent. And someone told me about a new guy who was hired in physiology by the name of Garland Marshall. And I went up, and he and I, I don't even think I had a technician yet. I asked for the reagent, and what are you doing? He was building peptides. He was the guy who invented solid phase peptide synthesis, Bruce Merrifield. He was his first graduate, and he was making analogs of this 8 amino acid peptide angiotensin. So for a year, we became friends, and we had lunch, and we kept talking, well, someday we ought to do something together. Now, I had learned biological assay systems where you could take pieces of tissue and measure responses. So from that discussion, I said, well, look, he was changing the amino acids to try and measure the response and chemical reactions in solution, where you measure NMR, you measure how molecules are bent in light and so on. And I said, well, what does it do to biological activity? And he kind of said, oh, yeah, it does. That's right. They are biologically active. It took us about a year, and the first compound we tested was the first selective inhibitor of the angiotensin receptor site. Now, we did the experiment a certain way, and he thought it was over just to see how active the molecules were. It was poor. And I said, well, wait, we haven't seen there's a receptor. He says, there are no receptors of small molecules. Dogma at the end of the 60s. He went up and got a book, and he showed me this whole book, A Siva Symposium, thousands and thousands of analogs. I said, Garland, you're taking longer than I can do the experiment. Within 30 days, we published in the PNAS. So I got the head of the department, the first angiotensin receptor antagonist. And it was great because you interacted a chemist and a biologist. We even went to the other society's meetings, and he would talk about the biology. They don't know any chemistry. And so we did a range of things about diseases, new inhibitors, and so on. And then that led me to my work in prostaglandins, because angiotensin affected prostaglandin. But it was a collaboration. It was multidisciplinary. And then you superimpose, it's Washington U, and then it's the NIH. Of course, what the NIH does, if you compete for a grant, is it really sets you free. I mean, you certainly contract for a certain body of research, and there's an unknown component. But it gives you two things. It gives you the resources to experiment in other areas. And by the way, you're raising part of your salary. Now, it pays to be a citizen of a university. It's kind of like the Plains Indian when he had a horse in a European state on the East Coast. So the beauty of the NIH and collaborators really so strongly influenced what I could get done.
At that phase, were you thinking of drugs, or were you more intensely in the basic research?
I suspect you could say I was selfish in that I just was totally involved in the joy of the hunt, solving problems, you know, walking on the moon, turning over a rock. I eventually started to attract students. And that's wonderful. I mean, later in life, one of the differences between academia and industry is the lack of pre-docs and post-docs, by and large. And, you know, because they are the fountain of youth. They're irreverent. They're uninhibited. They're massively energetic. And if you have a bunch of them together, wonderful sparks could happen. So very interesting and productive environment for going ahead in problems. Xerox machines were barely good. This was pre-computer. I mean, every Saturday we would put up pieces of butcher paper on the wall, and we would do diagrams and things. And on Saturday, it was brainstorming day, violate dogma. Let's have ideas, as long as you can reduce it to a hypothesis. So a pretty engaging group. And it led to angiotensin led to prostaglandins and to other kinds of things.
Prostaglandins, how did you get started on that?
When we discovered the first angiotensin blocker, let me back off. It was pretty clear already from the works in the 40s and 50s that there were sets of patients who had massive hypertension, and a pathologist, Goldblatt, looked at the kidneys of these patients who died, and it looked to him, the individual unit of the kidney is the nephron, as if each unit, as if it had a clamp on it. So he clamped the renal artery and reconstituted hypertension. And then brilliant work, a lot of it done in the Cleveland Clinic, showed the kidney produced a protein called renin. Renin then goes out and works on a protein that's a big inactive protein that's produced in the liver, and it clips it down to about a 14 amino acid piece. And then there's a clip to a 10 amino acid piece. So that renin is out in the circulation. And a 10 amino acid piece on a piece of blood vessel, it has low activity. One pass through the lung clips off two more to the 8 amino acid piece, angiotensin II. And that causes profound hypertension. And the world thought that 2 to 5% of all hypertensive patients were renin-dependent, angiotensin-driven. That later was proven wrong, and it gave birth to all the ACE inhibitors, and it's used in all kinds of hypertension. But the angiotensin II antagonists, so clearly right away we could show its effect on isolated vessels. We made models of renal hypertension and showed we could lower renal hypertension. Then I remember filling up Brown Butcher paper with Garland, and we had a couple of matching NIH grants then. And I said, those are obvious. Where is angiotensin doing something that's much more important in the regulation of the total body? And there were two important problems. In the adrenal gland, it controlled aldosterone release. Aldosterone is a hormone that controls the sodium and potassium levels, and it's important in the kidney in regulating your salt and water balance. All of these things you'll see later influence my later decision tree. And then an Englishman and a guy in the U.S. showed that angiotensin caused the kidney to release prostaglandin. I thought prostaglandin was stuff and aldosterone was the action. And I remember flying out to a guy who was one of the world leaders in aldosterone research. And I spent several days with him. And it took several days, multiple analytical things, including paper chromatography. And in about a week, you can get 5 data points. And I'm a lot of things, but I'm not patient. So then I looked up prostaglandins. I think my research grants then were still small dollars. There were only two ways in the world to do prostaglandin. You could do it by gas chromatography, mass spec, with a machine that was $150,000 and a lot of years of training. Or you could do smooth muscle bioassays that twitch with a piece. I said, well, let's do prostaglandins. And then through someone who was very important, he got me connected to the Englishman John Vane. And John Vane had really worked out elegantly bioassay systems for prostaglandins that were just extraordinary. So he agreed to take me for a mini sabbatical, and I was going to be there for maybe 3 months. He greatly influenced my life. I only spent 7 days, but it actually changed my thinking. I was able to quickly show that indeed the kidney production of prostaglandin by angiotensin was blockable by the specific antagonist, and everything was operative. Other actions of angiotensin were due to prostaglandin. But it also, again, reinforced for me for the power of a system that's hardly used anymore, and that's biological assays with pieces of muscle. Because you have to do certain things to convince yourself that the twitch isn't an artifact, but it's instant gratification. And you can instantly manipulate. And in the John Vane method, you strung up 3 tissues on top of each other, and you bathe it with salt, and each tissue's response to prostaglandin, where it twitches, generates unique curves that are kind of biological simultaneous equations, and when you fit. So I came back. Now we were going to the Cleveland meetings, so it's the angiotensin antagonist, and prostaglandin was creeping into the Cleveland meetings, and so we gave the first three antagonists, and then we'd given angiotensin prostaglandin. And there was a great physiologist at Harvard by the name of Cliff Barger, who now died. There was a big debate in the prostaglandin world, because if you took the kidney and if you did a slice across the middle, the outer circle is the cortex, the inner one is the medulla, and then there's the papilla. The prostaglandin was 95% or more in this inner place and not up here. Yet, if you measure blood flow in the kidney, it's up here. How the hell could that happen? So this guy, Barger, had this very elegant work where he showed with injecting latex that from deep down there, there were special vessels that came up to the resistance determinant. Blood vessels that were known as ascending vasa recta, but no one ever knew a function, and he assigned a function. And I said, Cliff, that's bull. And as with many things I did with students, I'll bet you a Coke you're wrong. I can tell you I've had postdocs who worked for 6 months to win a Coke for me. So I met a urologist there, and I said, how could I disrupt that flow from the kidney? He says, tie off the ureter, and you make a model of the human disease hydronephrosis. Hydronephrosis, for example, can happen commonly with a woman in pregnancy if the fetus leads against the ureter and leads to all the back pressure. And there's other inflammation. Well, it makes an inflammatory kidney. We took out that kidney, put it bathing these three tissues, and that bathed gold for 10 years. The tissues exploded with massive productions of prostaglandins and even prostaglandins that the kidney didn't make. I spent the better part of 10 years figuring that out. And that really led to the COX-2 discovery, because it was a whole induction of another enzyme that's not normally expressed. So it came from bioassays and then biochemistry. Pharmacology is a bastard science, so you use whatever you have to. Prostaglandins in the 70s and 80s was fixated on all the different prostaglandins the body made, but no one was studying the enzymes and how they're regulated. So by default, and influenced by my colleagues, by this time I was head of the department, so I went from postdoc to head of the department in 9 years because they never saw a pharmacologist before. And the department is a very interesting thing because we only had one meeting a year, but we met three times a week for journal clubs and research seminars. And every other research seminar had to be out of your field. And students came in a flood. And there, it became clear I better learn cell biology and molecular biology. So we developed antibodies. We used tissue culture technique from the intact inflamed kidney. We identified the cells. We identified the cytokines. We pulled out, with antibodies, the proteins. With help, we pulled out the messenger RNA. So we found that the messenger was turned on, and the message didn't pull down conventional cyclooxygenase, which, with collaborating with someone in the department, we were the first to pull out the conventional one. With the proper cDNA probe, we couldn't get the right induced enzyme, and it was different than the COX-1. And that led me in 1990 already to propose that there were two enzymes. One that's housekeeping, that just maintains the stomach, the platelets, and so on. And one that is shut off in the body because it works out the adrenal gland releases things like cortisone. And cortisone suppresses the expression of that gene. And we even showed in animals, if you remove the adrenals, the stuff blasts on. So if you're circulating the level, shut it off. That was the beginning of the COX-2 hypothesis.
Was it grouped in with COX-1 and nobody knew? And they
no one knew it was another one.
So they just,
and the luck is the polyclonal antibody that we raised in rabbits pulled them both out. And I hypothesized that all the aspirin-like drugs, non-steroid anti-inflammatories, could not discriminate. And furthermore, hypothesized that the problem in pain and inflammation and swelling had to be COX-2 and not COX-1. But Ali Lowry, my mentor, postdoc mentor, always taught me that a hypothesis is something you have to disprove. So we did not know it was the engine of inflammation. We didn't know the COX-1. We didn't know the NSAIDs. But we did know. Pause. Dripping out of that hydronephrotic kidney wasn't just prostaglandins, which kind of twitch pieces of intestine. There was another one called thromboxane. Thromboxane is mostly known because it's what the platelet makes. So it's still cyclooxygenase. We have stimulated platelet, it makes thromboxane. Thromboxane contracts the blood vessels and clumps more platelets. And it is an engine of myocardial infarction and ischemia. That kidney was pouring out thromboxane. So now my laboratory is filled with all these MD, PhD students and graduates and postdocs, and we're all kind of lathering together all the time. Another guy was very interested in a problem about a different kidney in the cell that made a lot of prostaglandin, but no one knew how it was turned on. So the enzyme was there. If you threw in the fat that drives it, it worked. So he came across a paper in a trashy journal that you would be ashamed to put a paper in. And there was this Canadian pathologist who was studying rats and giving them high doses of salt. And his name was DeBold, and he recognized that in the heart, in the atria, the higher the salt, the more grains. For 20 years, people were hunting for the natriuretic hormone. They knew there was some kind of a hormone that must affect sodium. So he thought maybe that was it. So what he did is he ground up the atrium of these rats and injected them other rats to see if it affected urine volume and urine sodium. The error bars were so big you could almost use a fold-out in the journal. So it didn't have much traction. So this young postdoc made the extract, then he put on tissue culture cells to see if it released prostaglandin, and it didn't. So I said, well, go inject some of it on that hydronephrotic kidney. You know, that's a prostaglandin factoring. He called me over, and he said, Phil, you ought to look at this. So you have these three tissues. The hydronephrotic kidney makes them contract like mad. He adds the extract to the kidney, and the blood vessels relax. He said, what do you think of that? I said, forget the kidney, inject it below the kidney, and the blood vessel relax. I start jumping around, screaming. I said, everybody here, what does this mean? I said, ladies and gentlemen, today we become cell and molecular biologists, and we could get the natriuretic hormone. I said, assume the guy is right. So that meant you had a hormone that lowered salt. Oh, and then we injected ventricle, and it did nothing. This data shows the hormone also relaxed blood vessel. If I wanted to invent an endocrinology system that controlled blood pressure, sodium, and volume, I put it in the atrium because heart comes out high pressure, goes through the whole circulation, across the capillaries, you lose most of the pressure, it limps back to the heart. The slightest change in pressure and volume on the atria is a great transducer. So your heart says something wrong, it releases a pre-stored hormone, relaxes the blood vessel, lowers the volume. It's an endocrine loop. So we started in that. And then interestingly, we had an invention then of the Washington-U-Monsanto agreement, which was an internal grant program given out by the faculty. Now, I could not have written for an NIH grant at that time that says, I'm going to isolate, purify, clone, express, and work out a whole endocrine system. But I could get a Washington U grant from them because there was a study section. There were four members of the National Academy and four members from the industry. Long story short, it took the single run of 5,000 rat hearts to get to the sequence. And by the way, we didn't have the relevant skills at Washington U. Monsanto had the great skills. So I went out and we sequenced the peptide, and as you come with the sequence, it's nonsense. You know, so you're searching the computer, and remember, this is early 80s. So we were simultaneously synthesizing it, and within a week of these nonsense sequences of the three peptides, we reconstituted with the material. So, and then we worked out all the endocrinology. It also controlled the adrenal gland that affects vasopressin, and it also would have led to a drug. And we had all the patents of atropepsin 1 and 2. By the way, when I started thromboxane, I discovered the first thromboxane synthetase inhibitor. Because of studying prostaglandins, I was interested in fatty acid. I worked out all the biochemistry of omega-3 fatty acids. So we had atropepsin, we had the angiotensin antagonist, we had thromboxane. COX-2 then was kind of the point at which I realized two things. It's rare in academia you see a problem from beginning to the end. You know, you love what you're doing, and especially if you have bright people, good things happen that are pretty important and get into journals, and I kind of liked having grants. I mean, I didn't mind. So I had 2 5-year grants and 3-year grants, each a year out of phase. I was always writing. So while people gritch, and I'm sure it was easier when I was there, but you don't see a problem from beginning to end. You don't do big team research, and academia is clueless about development. So I knew that the thromboxane synthetase inhibitor should have been a drug. I think the therapeutic use of fish oils could have been accelerated. When Garland Marshall and I discovered the first angiotensin receptor antagonist, the university told us to pay for the patent ourselves. Different times. So when it came to COX-2, I knew I had to go. If I was going to finish it. And it was very, very hard. I love being chief. I knew I wouldn't leave St. Louis. And by the way, it was Roy Vagelos, who was the head of biochemistry, who left and went to Merck. And he wanted me to go to Merck. He tried to recruit me 3 times, but I wouldn't leave St. Louis. But he really enlightened me about how you could really use good science in industry.
In industry.
Before that, I was really negative. Just the way I was very negative about venture capital. But then I could see what he did at Merck was special. So when Monsanto in St. Louis offered me to be chief scientist, they let me keep my laboratory and postdocs at Washington U. I did that a couple days a week and run it. And then I had enlightened CEOs. I hear all the grief, but they let me try to run Monsanto as if it was a big NIH grant. We used rigorous reviews that are exact copies of the program project reviews that I sat on NIH, and we used expert. And by the way, I think the NIH went much too far in restricting the use of those people as consultants. Don't you see a strong, data-driven, unbiased, hard-nosed advice is the thing that industry needs most to get it straight? Then I learned in industry, one thing I didn't know in academia is development really requires lots of inventions. And it's very hard. And there's only one route to heaven. There's not so many. In academia, good things happen if you have bright things. But then I saw when you get people to understand the vision and what you're after, where else could you mobilize the best of cell biology, molecular biology, chemistry, clinical sciences, pharmacology, and really, so it took us just a couple of years to prove that the hypothesis was correct. Most problems that I knew, it was years before you had a reagent, but there was enough literature to give us clues about COX inhibitors that we able to start synthesis programs. Someone else came up with the clone, the sequence, Harvey Hirschman in Los Angeles. But then from that, we could clone human, mouse, dog, every species, COX-1, COX-2 as reagents. We could start the industrial manufacture of proteins so we could do crystallography. When we started, only 4 membrane-bound proteins had been crystallized. We did 24 crystallizations with COX-2. Anyone who solved the crystal structure of COX-2 would have known how to make a $1 billion drug, because there was an assumption about the crystal structure which was wrong, and COX-2 opens up a pocket that's not in COX-1. If you take the old kind of NSAIDs and fill that space, you make inhibitors. And then we did all the clinical trials and invented. All the problems with COX-2 came after my watch, and none of that was clear in any of the preclinical safety, mm-hmm. You can't tell. I have interesting attitudes about the issues around that.
What's
now.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah. But we reinvented the company. We reinvented science. We used it in other areas. Most important, we discovered, and we were very, very open at every stage. We supplied antibodies, chemicals, cDNA probes. As soon as we had the data, we had expert rheumatologists as part of it. And they were very big help. And in those collaborations, I think the most important part of COX-2 is not arthritis. It's not the pain, the swelling, the feeling like you're walking on glass. I mean, that's relief. It's that it looks like every epithelial cancer, precancerous, cancerous, and metastatic, is overexpression of COX-2. And people have shown, academics have shown, it is sufficient to cause cancer. This magnificent work from a guy from University of Connecticut, where he uses this breast-specific promoter, sticks human COX-2 in the mouse. You see some change in proliferation. Take those mice through 3 rounds of pregnancy, they all have adenocarcinoma, and some of them metastasize. Mm-hmm. Now, that is not alone the mechanism, but it shows it's sufficient. So then there's one other part about cancer. There's all these old NSAIDs around. So here is some epidemiology. We really got interested in cancer when I went to the NIH, and this woman who runs the Tennessee medical program for every prescription that's given for NSAIDs, and she tracked 83,000 patients, and she compared them to cohorts, 50% reduction in colon cancer, but then with a point, she said, but look at all these ulcers.
So these are the post-aspirin and aspirin, or?
But they were mostly ibuprofen. These were prescription. So it was naproxen and ibuprofen and probably Dapro. And so there really is a compelling case. And so the current debate about cardiovascular is pretty interesting. I think they came out right on Vioxx. I also did Bextra. I think they came out right on Bextra because it has no advantage. So. But there were patients who have Stevens-Johnson, this inflammation of the skin, which is so bad patients die. by the way, the public clamor about, is the FDA doing right? Is data being 6 cases in a million? There is no way for you to project a chronic agent.
Why is there such an outcry then? Is it because those weren't reported?
No, they were, well, the outcry was the cardiac responses.
Right.
But then there's just a whole outcry when you see something in patients after a drug is released.
Mm-hmm.
The Celebrex trials were the biggest arthritis trials of all time. If I wanted a conventional NSAID, that's 1,500 patients. We did 14,000 patients. We did 5,000 endoscopies. People didn't do that. When you do a clinical trial, you look in a population that has a single disease and you try and get rid of all the confounding variables. So you look at the incidence of side effects during that. By the way, now I'm learning all of the pharmaceutical industry, which I keep finding more and more interesting. Because everyone worships the hypothesis and the idea, now how do you make a drug? Well, when you get to the trials, you study populations of patients. Now, the question is long-term safety. Arthritis patients can't move their arms, they're in wheelchairs, they're stiff, they feel like they're walking on glass. You put them on a double-blind placebo trial, their dropout rate is so great that you put in double the initial enrollment to keep them in for 6 months even, and you have to promise them that after the blind is broken, they'll get drug until it's approved by the FDA. So there was no way to do a long, long safety trial. It's only when we started the cancer trials and then showed FAP, those placebos don't feel a difference in their symptoms. And it took 6 months and you could see about a 30 to 40% reduction in the polyps. That, by the way, was a trial that industry didn't want to do. Why take a good, clean drug into those patients who could bring a lot of dirty symptoms? But because science had a big part of the table, we did it, and we picked FAP patients, familial adenoma polyposis, because 100% of those kids, each of their parents has a mutation of a gene called APC. By teenagers, they'll have thousands of polyps. They're precancerous until 30. That becomes adenocarcinoma. Most of them are dead at 42 to 45. It's only a couple thousand in the world. Why do the trial? We did the trial because big time spontaneous or sporadic adenomatous polyposis in this country, 90,000 patients, maybe 50,000 deaths, they acquire the same mutation and overexpress COX-2. It's the canary in the coal mine. So it's only in those trials that it would come out. Now, Vioxx and Celebrex, Celebrex was a little bit ahead, came out, but Vioxx appears to me, and it's still a debate, but to have molecule-based side effects. It certainly causes a rise in blood pressure, even at the arthritic doses. And in the year 2000, there was already data of MI and stroke, but there was an argument its control naproxen, it didn't have a placebo because it was arthritis, was protective. We started Celebrex trial before I left and it was continued in Pfizer. It was underway 3 years. Merck was 18 months into the Vioxx trial and they saw the signal. And it was clear and it was pronounced and they withdrew the drug. Now the safety committees on the Celebrex trial, I think I was told by this time that there were 70 trials in cancer with Celebrex. Academics, all kinds of people. The safety monitoring board put much higher criteria. That was run by the National Cancer Institute that we did the FAP trial. And they looked, and indeed there was a Celebrex signal versus placebo. I've seen that data. It's published. It's really good data. There's no question about it. There's a signal. Three other trials now have been done, two in cancer and one with all that. No signal. And in the Alzheimer's trial versus placebo, naproxen has the signal. In pharmaceuticals, death trumps everything. You never wipe out that signal, but its incidence is quite low, and that was at the 800 milligram dose or the 400 milligram, which is more than, because oncologists like to use more, not enough. So I think it's a low incident. The FDA shut down Vioxx. They functionally shut down Baxter. They said 32 to 1 to keep going with Celebrex. To me, the unfortunate part is they haven't reported yet the oncology data. And it's my impression from the Data Safety Monitoring Board, it's profound. So later, there'll be a benefit risk. And the last thing I'll say, you look at benefit risk, if you stayed at the right dose, I would say it was way over marketed. Mm-hmm. only maybe something like 20 to 30% were at GI risk who needed COX-2 mm-hmm. over NSAIDs. So it was over market, and direct to consumer is pretty distorting. So a lot of people were taking it. It probably brought about 10% more into the market who just couldn't tolerate it.
Yep.
So over marketing and direct to consumer, I think there could be change. There is a population that changes their quality of their life. So the benefit risk ratio there makes sense. If epithelial cancer or other cancers work, that benefit risk ratio is very different. And the last part is NSAIDs probably have the signal. And, you know, if I mean, when I left, it was already 27 million people who have been on Celebrex prescriptions. NSAIDs are hundreds of millions. So there is a background in that. But then closing the final loop, it is pretty interesting to see some kind of ground-up tube to all the patients. I think medications in patients has a high degree of complexity. A chemical molecule goes in the body, and it fits a unique three-dimensional space that has characteristics that you could study in the pure enzyme, but I don't know in the other billions of spaces what else it could do. So molecule-based toxicities are a different kind of issue. So it was not so popular for most of my colleagues to think about going into industry, when in fact it's actually what you need the most of now is this data-driven right. analysis of such thorny problems. As I watch it gets threshed out in the press and even the advisory committees, I was underwhelmed by the knowledge of the committees. So I could use some hard-nosed expert.
Was part of the reason they objected was that the data was not available to other people outside of industry?
The major data belonged to the NCI, so they're the ones who had to report out the data.
Mm.
Excuse me, I think you're right. I mean, there was never a journalist interested in negative data. I think all the pressure on having trials reported right away is fine. I think you could use much more rigorous post-marketing analysis. But you see, now it's kind of a voluntary system. I mean, the doctors or the patients or the company has to report it to the FDA. There's no formal way to track adverse reactions. I don't think there's any way that you could legislate longer trials. In fact, there was a lot of effort about how could you do a comparative trial now in the cardiovascular safety of COX-2. You'll need 30 or 50,000 patients for many years and how big it is. And so you better have a clear understanding of the benefit risk mm-hmm. and expert review. I have not found the FDA reviews as rigorous or sophisticated as an NIH study section.
That's a problem.
Well, they pay him very little. You know, there was a lot of criticism about this agreement that the FDA is being funded by the pharmaceutical industry. Where did that come from? The reviews, the drugs were sitting in reviews for 27 months. So the pharmaceutical industry agreed to pay a fee for its review so they could have more people do the reviews. But the government cut down the amount of money. It wasn't new money. So yeah, you created a bad situation. There's not enough physicians. They're dedicated people. The better the agency, I think the better off everybody is,
yeah.
including the pharmaceutical industry, because it was difficult to negotiate opinions
yeah.
or get guidance.
What about this finding, and I don't know if it's been replicated, that you can, if somebody has a heart attack, you give them an aspirin right then, it can...
I don't know that work very much. I mean, I think the primary work that came from those big physician health studies and ISIS trials were on secondary prevention, and mm-hmm. that's very clear. It's my impression that primary prevention, it's also good data, but I don't know it well enough. But understand, with aspirin, there's a certain percentage of hemorrhagic stroke, and there's even a certain percentage of ulcers. I mean, so there is a certain... Yeah, I think if you got into the chronic safety of aspirin, you'd probably have a problem. I myself think you, to use therapeutics in a chronic way, there's a certain level of risk. If there's not an alternative therapy, then you have to consider the risk. That's why I don't disagree that Bextra had a better alternative, so you can do without it.
Well, that's unusual from someone who's been...
Well, I discovered it with you. I mean,
yeah.
No, but I mean, science is always a self-correcting institution.
Right.
You can't deal in absolutes. I would say even investigating the mechanisms of what's going on in oncology or what's going on in stroke, you know, there was a theory out there about why the COX-2 inhibitors were causing the problem, and they were trying to say it's mechanism-based. I don't think that's right, and I don't think the data supports that, because the patients who had the big Vioxx problem were on low-dose aspirin also. Mm-hmm. So it couldn't have been platelet COX-1 thromboxane. So you see the characters in my play, I guess it's not surprising you learn certain pathways and certain things, and you think about problems, and you have analytics that take you in different places. So probably they're mostly a cardiovascular, inflammatory, metabolism in the body, regulation, pretty nifty problems.
Are you working on some now?
Well, so I was at Washington U for 25 years and then went into industry. That's kind of interesting because I sat at one of my desks in St. Louis, and it was four different companies.
Oh, this
so
was
I started
Monsanto.
As chief scientist of Monsanto. Then they also wanted me to run serial R&D. Then in the Pharmacia exercise, I was then chief scientist of all of that. And I chose not to go to Pfizer because I would have had to leave St. Louis. You know, I really love being in academia. I think I might have liked the applied science of industry even more. If I could subtract out all the time you spent in regulatory or then in litigation kinds of things.
Right.
But, you know, big team research with bright and light and people to attack a problem when they really, really zero in on the problem, that's pretty special. So I would do that kind of thing again. But even when they asked me to go from chief scientist at Monsanto to also running the pharmaceutical arm, they say you have to move to Chicago. I said, go back to academia. And they said, well, what do you have in mind? I said, I won't be away from CIMA more than 3 days or two nights. So we did that. Then the Pharmacia merger came, says, well, you have to move to PPAC right next to Morristown. I said, no, I'm not going to be away from CIMA more than 3 days and two nights. Okay, we'll try it. And they let me use the company plane, and I loaded up with 10 people or so when we would go. It did mean 4:45 in the morning, so I could spend the night before. And so I spend a lot of time trying to help in St. Louis startup companies. In Israel, I'm trying to help them build the National Institute of Biotechnology in the Negev. I'm experimenting in venture capital in that it has one part that I liked in the industry, and that is, what do you want to bet on in science? What's the killer experiment? And by the way, I told you the joy of the hunt, there is the pleasure of the kill. And so there's a whole discipline that's both scientific and managerial about how you get through the trials and do critical things and manage budgets and meet deadlines. And that's pretty fascinating. So I'm pretty lucky that I've done all of academia and industry and even seeing in venture capital how people make bets. And there's parts of it that are likable and parts of it that aren't. Venture capitalists are about an exit strategy. They're often lemmings, so they like to build syndicates. They're somewhat risk adverse about what they do. So it was pretty interesting that they were willing for someone who's so technology driven to be the beginning of the cascade. But what it all suffers from is you don't dig into a problem and help it happen all the way. And you know, there's three things you can do with advice, and the third thing is take the part that you want. So if I give advice and it's of no interest, I'm not going to, I lose interest in that.
Because they're not participating then, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And small venture capital companies academia has changed so much, and there's so much entrepreneurial spirit in academia, but they're often built around one idea and one product, and there's more bad news than good news. I mean, when it works out, it's great. But if it succeeds in preclinical, it then consumes so much funds in the development phase that they walk away from their unique competitive advantage. If it fails, they're dead. And venture capitalists aren't so interested in technologies. I mean, the real growth potential is in major therapeutics.
Right.
The most interesting part of drug development, intellectually, is from the discovery to proof of concept. There's still a lot of work, but that's probably the place at which big pharma could jump in. I actually think the whole world of drug development is getting much closer to the right kind of revolution. I mean, here at the Academy, we spend so much time on genomics and genomic sciences. The reason I went back to Washington U, actually Sim and I endowed a chair for them to try and do, is the fact of the matter is it doesn't seem to have shortened the time from a great discovery to the patient. How do you change that dynamic? Well, academia could begin to attack that in different ways. You know, do the industrial collection of patient samples and then really build the database and do the analytics of the genes, the proteins, match it with the database at a hospital so you have the phenotype, zero in on a target, do the knockouts, really validate a target. That's academia. That's not industry. Industry could provide the tools, the drugs, or so on. I think clinical trials should change, and I think they should be done in great academic centers. Phase one clinical trial now is safety. You do ascending dose, and is it safe? And you do a little bit of pharmacokinetics, the blood levels. Phase one should be proof of mechanism of action. So because most drugs are not used at the optimum dose, you're measuring some phenomena and a response without a wide range. But if you show the mechanism and when you hit that mechanism, and then phase two, when it can be, should be pre-selected stratified patients based on some marker. Sometimes it comes from a microarray, but that's oversold, but some mechanism or marker that allows a small academic control trial that matches the symptoms with the mechanism. Then big pharma ought to roar in for the brute force of what it takes in managerial. And there's a lot of things that have to be done. That was kind of my vision for Washington U. I think that's the way I like to read the Zerhouni proposal to NIH in the roadmap.
You think that could come to be?
Well, I think the academic revolution is team research. You see, in my day, each scientist was kind of an individual scientific entrepreneur. You occasionally collaborated. And there were even center grants, but they were more artificial than real, and they came and they went. I'm beginning to see the evolution of some big interdisciplinary research, mm-hmm. and they should go out of the hospitals and medical schools, too. Bioengineering, physics, other kinds of disciplines could be involved. So I'm a big fan of interdisciplinary research, and then academia is going to have to understand how do we do promotions, how do we recognize individuals. How do we make a tenure decision? I would like to see the metrics of this model of phase one, phase two as JCI, Journal of Clinical Investigation, or New England Journal. So they should still be doing academic kinds of research. That's what I'd like to see. That's what I try to help them do.